Quick update. I'm launching a new course for 2025. It's Foundations of Application Security. It's a two-day bootcamp covering everything you need to become a well-rounded AppSec practitioner. There's both public and private courses available, and the best part about it all is taught by me. So if you're interested, just send me an email, call@galahcyber.com.au, or say hi on LinkedIn if you can have a chat about it.
At the time, I had just managed to convince my parents that there is a legitimate industry for computer security and they should let me study computer science, which I was grateful for that they came around to that, but it took a lot of convincing. Nowadays, it's a different world. Everyone knows that cybersecurity is a hot field.
Hi, I'm Cole Cornford, and this is Secured, the podcast that dives deep into the world of application security. On this episode, I'm joined by Shubham Shah, more commonly known in the industry as Shubs. Shubs is the co-founder and chief technology officer of AssetNote, an attack surface management product used by companies like Atlassian, Qantas, and Australia Post. Shubs' career in cybersecurity had humble beginnings. He told me he first learned to hack computer games just as a way to beat his brother as a kid. We chat a bit more about video game exploits and what we can learn about application security from them, about being effective with bug bounties, the challenges of founding companies, and plenty more. So let's jump right in. Hey, how you going, Shubs?
Yeah, good. Just in sunny Brisbane, enjoying the weather and excited to chat to you.
Brisbane's beautiful. Why did it change from Sydney to Brisbane in particular?
Well, actually, it was mostly because most of my team work here in Brisbane. And even though we're a fully remote company, I decided to move over to be closer to them, especially my co-founder as well.
Yeah, because I know that, like, I'm in Newcastle, so I'm not terribly far away from Brisbane. Like, it's a 30-minute flight, I guess. So I really understand the wanting to be close to your family and your friends and your team members especially. I've always, like, kind of, with a remote first company, struggled a little bit with, you know, building that camaraderie. So it makes sense to just be co-located where you can.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been seeing a bunch of companies move back to working in the office and things like that, but they all claim that creativity is something that only gets spawned in an office. I don't know if I fully agree with that, but I do love making relationships with my team and I do love spending time with them when possible.
Yeah, I think I really miss, like, when I was working at the ATO and at Westpac, there was that just going out for pub lunches and playing pool. Or at Westpac, we used to go to a place called The Office, which is a pub across the road from Westpac. So you could tell your missus that you're at the office all day.
That's a good one.
I know. They're really smart branding there. But the thing is, you build those connections and with people from all sorts of different parts of cybersecurity that you otherwise wouldn't have been able to remotely. And I do feel that working with a remote company that I don't get those kind of relationships anymore. So, but Brisbane, anyway, sounds like it's the right place to be. So first question I usually ask people come onto the podcast is, what kind of bird are you and why?
I'm a kookaburra, and the reason why is because there are just so many things that can bring you down in life, and it's important to remember to laugh, and kookaburras love laughing, so that's all.
I love that answer. I get kookaburras outside my house quite frequently.
Yeah, I think that they're a gem of a native bird in Australia, for sure.
It sounds like, you know, you've got to smile and look at, have you had some, like, harder times, and so you've had to adopt that kind of persona yourself, like, to get through those? Is that how it is with the kookaburra, or?
Yeah, I think generally I've been a pretty happy person, and I think even though there have been a lot of setbacks throughout my journey and career, I've always found ways to make those things a positive influence in my life, and usually find that if I move forward, not backwards, and have a positive attitude, smiling as much as I can, as long as I still feel that way, then things end up working out quite well. One of my friends used to always say to me, he says that adversity builds character, but I don't need any more character.
You got to make sure, I think that it's a good attitude to, you know, be positive and to look at things, but not to the point where you just are positive when things are collapsing around you. And
yeah, yeah.
I think that betrayed a lot of people are taught, like, I guess it's called toxic positivity, I think. I'm not really an armchair psychologist guy, so I don't really know.
No, but I do think there's a level of pragmatism required with all of this. I mean, I try to be positive about the things that I can control, and if there are things that I can't control, I try and figure out what I can do about them as best as I can. But at the end of the day, it's we still always have our sad periods.
That's it. God give me the serenity, right?
Yeah.
I need to learn that one and stick it up on my wall so I don't just have, like, pictures of galahs everywhere is my only thing. next question is going to be about your career. So could you tell us about where you came from and just a bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to be a founder of a company?
Yeah, sure. So I come from an immigrant family that moved to Australia in the year 2000. I was around 3 years old, and my parents came here. They basically only had one bag of luggage and us two kids, my older brother and myself. And we moved to the suburb of Campsie in New South Wales. And basically back then, we were staying at one of our cousins' places and we didn't have much money. My dad went through multiple different jobs to, I guess, provide for the family. All sorts of odd jobs, things all the way ranging from cutting out plastic keychains to working in factories and all sorts of things like that. Through their hard work, eventually, you know, we were able to get our own apartment, and we went all sleeping in one room. And that was tremendous for us. My parents always tried very hard to provide for us. But at the age of maybe 11 or 12, my dad had bought a computer for us. And that computer was very, very expensive at the time. I'm pretty sure he used quite a lot of his savings for us. And as usual, my older brother was the one who usually was using that computer with very little opportunity for me to use it as well. But I still got to watch him play games. And that was a really important part of my early life, playing online games with my brother. And eventually I realized that I am absolutely terrible at games. I cannot beat my brother for the world of me. I mean, he's a few years older than me, but that was no excuse for me. I really wanted to beat him at all costs. So I got into game hacking, and I was probably 12, 13 back then. And all sorts of game hacking, I mean, FPS games, online games, things like that, and started joining these forums on the internet, which would discuss different techniques, different tools that you could use. At the time, I was engineering custom cheat engines for games so that they would be undetected by the anti-cheat engines that these games were using online. Doing this work, I started to really fall in love with all sorts of different areas of computers and programming and how everything works and everything fits together. I mean, I still had a very spotty picture. I came from no fundamentals, just dived straight into it and tried to figure things out along the way. After finally beating my brother by cheating in games successfully, I realized that there was more areas of computer security adjacent to game security that I was very interested in, specifically web application security. And while I was learning all of this stuff, at the time there were a number of forums that had tutorials on different things regarding web application security. While I was learning all of this stuff, I had also started working at Hungry Jack's, which for the Americans, that's the equivalent of Burger King in Australia. And yeah, I was there for around 8 months. I worked there basically on the back end and just, I guess, prepping burgers and things like that, making $6.50 an hour. And, you know, at the time, I was really grateful that I even got that job. I was stoked that they gave me a chance, which is, you know, such a... In retrospect, I'm sure they would have hired any 14-year-old kid for $6.50 an hour, but at the time, I felt very, very grateful. And yeah, I tried doing my best at Hungry Jack's, but I worked there for around 8 months, made around $800. And at the time, I was also reporting vulnerabilities to bug bounties. Now, bug bounties were just a relatively new concept at the time. We had Microsoft, which had their bug bounty, and PayPal that followed shortly after. With the PayPal bug bounty, I had reported several bugs that didn't get accepted by them. But it wasn't something that stopped me from reporting more issues or looking for more issues. Also, I'll have to say that at the time, I really didn't know what I was doing. Some of the bugs that I was reporting to them had little to no security impact. And, you know, if today I got bug reports like that, I would immediately mark them as informative or not applicable. But even then, I still, I guess, pursued this line of bug bounty hunting at the time. And eventually I did find a relatively serious bug, a server-side request forgery bug inside Bill Me Later, which is an acquisition of PayPal. And that server-side request forgery bug let me access any internal host inside the Bill Me Later and PayPal network. Overnight, they paid $1.5K USD. And basically, I never showed up at Hungry Jack's after that.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned Hungry Jack's to me, because my last podcast guest also told me that he had a lot of character development specifically for working for Hungry Jack's for 3 years.
Yeah. 3 years is a lot longer than I was able to stick it out. So I have to give him props for that.
And so there's a lot to unpack there, man. So I also grew up in a family where, honestly, my parents weren't terribly computer literate. So my mum was a laundry worker. Mm. So she was packing laundry for hospitals, basically. And she met my dad, who's a truck driver who was driving his linen and laundry between hospitals. And like for them, I think a big lesson I learned is that people need to do shit jobs, right? Sometimes it doesn't matter if you're doing, you're running your own company or if you're, you know, just, you just have to accept that there's going to be parts of work that suck and you just need to do it, right?
Yeah.
And I know that my dad would, he's super disciplined, getting up at 2 to 3 every like 6 or 7 days a week, working overtime, 60 hours a week, just delivering laundry between hospitals, right? So I didn't see him as much as I would have liked to. And I'm hoping to change that kind of dynamic now that I have the ability to work remotely so I can spend time with my kids. But, you know, it's still instilled in me about wanting to work really hard for my family, right?
Yeah, I really resonate with that. It's a very similar experience to me because my dad had to work so hard, similar to your dad, putting in these overtime hours. I really rarely got to see him growing up. And it was actually very difficult for me to actually come to terms with all of that and understand that the reality of the situation was without his hard work, we wouldn't have had all the good things in life. But I know that you said that this reminds you of doing shit work, but really for me, I think that for both of us, I think what we've learned from this is having a solid work ethic, which is something that is quite hard to build up. And we've been fortunate enough to see our family, our parents go through such hardship and have this work ethic at all costs to provide for the family, that we've, I guess, been moved, inspired, instilled with the same sort of work ethic in our day-to-day lives.
Like, I feel like I'm incredibly privileged that I get to do a lot of different things. I get to run a podcast. That's pretty good. Where I just talk to cool people about, you know, their backgrounds and like interesting cybersecurity tidbits, right? But, you know, just if you think about the broad range of things we do within AppSec, I speak with engineers and help them design systems. I do code reviews. So I sit there and I look at source code and put the headphones on and just run through, where are these bugs at? You know, I work to help people architect and make right design choices. I teach developers. I get a variety of things that are all really fun and interesting to do in their own unique way. And sometimes that work can become monotonous or like bad in some way, but you look back and you say, hang on a second, actually, I'm incredibly privileged because right now I'm not driving trucks or linen between hospitals and doing this at 3 a.m. in the morning, 6 days a week, right?
Yeah, totally agree with you there. I mean, sometimes I even feel bad when speaking with, especially during the COVID times, when I would get into an Uber or something and I would say, you know, what did you do for work? And they'd be like, I just lost my job due to COVID. I was at a factory or something. And then they ask me what I do for work. I'm like, you know, I work remotely and I, you know, I don't have these issues. I'd almost feel bad talking about it because so many people have to struggle with the harsh realities of this economic climate, as well as, you know, not being privileged enough to be able to work from any location like you and I can. So it is very good to remember that. And I do understand that, like, you know, we have it quite well when it comes to the sort of work we're doing and the flexibility that we have with our work. It's good to remember that.
So if anybody's listening and they just need someone to talk to about like cybersecurity being hard, hit me or Shubs up. I'll be happy to have a listen to you guys. I did, I heard game hacking and I got really interested. I don't know, I'm not as interesting as you, but I do a lot of speedrunning of computer games and across a wide variety of platforms, so generally older ones. I did play competitive Team Fortress 2 for about 5-7 years.
Wow.
And so I do understand how the anti-cheat system works for VAC and all of that kind of stuff, and also knew what a lot of people were doing in that game specifically to effectively give them an advantage. So that is an area that's like really interesting to me too. Obviously, with speedruns, it's about finding ways that programmers didn't intend for people to play the game. And sometimes it's just very, very silly little things, right? Like in Chrono Trigger, if you use an elixir on the final boss, an elixir just heals max integer, right? But the boss's hit points is actually higher than max integer, so it overflows. And then they just die in one hit because it heals over the max integer.
That's awesome.
There's a lot of like little bugs like that for speed and finishing all these games really quickly. What kind of bugs did you identify or kinds of vulnerabilities did you find for game hacking that were interesting to you?
I was mostly looking at values that were controlled on the client side that had a real impact on the server side as well.
Yep.
So most of the online games that I was looking at, I think at the time, mainly I was focusing on two online games and they were made by the same game developer, which was Softnix at the time. And the games were Gunbound and Gunz. I don't know if they're super popular these days, but it was extremely popular back then. And I was looking at things like, basically I was creating undetected cheat engines. So Cheat Engine is the software that you can use to modify values in memory to maybe modify your health or maybe modify other values within the game. It attaches to a process and then it lets you modify these memory values and addresses. Essentially, what SoftNix had built was, or what they had was something called NProtect, which was a anti-cheat engine, which was basically any sort of hacking it would try to prevent, detect, and ban you. And the regular cheat engine that you can download would get automatically detected immediately. So there was a huge process involved in creating undetected cheat engines, which would involve you compiling the cheat engine project in a way that would prevent NProtect from being able to detect it. And once you had Cheat Engine going, you could start doing things like unlimited life hacks and things like that. I also briefly got into aimbotting as well and learning how to make aimbots for this game. For some context, Gunbound is like a game just like Worms, if you ever played Worms before.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's very similar to that. So an aimbot goes a long way.
Oh, like Worms, for those who don't really know, basically it's a game where it's a 2D map and you just have a team, like a bunch of different worms who need to shoot each other with weapons. And a big part of it is actually the ability to understand physics, right? Because it's about how do I move rockets from here to here without hitting random obstacles. And if you are able to get the trajectory and the power, like I think there was another one called Pocket Tanks. It's very similar. I used to play back when I was in high school. Yeah, if you could do that accurately every single time, you'd absolutely mercilessly crush the opponents. So I do like that idea of, I knew a lot about game hacking that was more passive. There was a few ways that people still to this day kind of do it. So ones I can talk to is in PUBG, which is a battleground game. I think this has been patched now, but one of the big parts of the game was actually having the ability to listen to audio and then be able to use that audio to understand the direction that a gunshot came from.
Oh, wow.
But what they would send to you as a packet on the network effectively is the exact position.
Oh, wow.
So you could, on a second monitor, split the network traffic to go to the other monitor and just like pretty much have a compass direction point where the person is going.
That's very cool.
And it's completely undetectable, man, because all that's happening is you're passively listening for traffic that's coming in, right? There's no interaction with the game client. All that they're seeing is it's going to your router and then the traffic's being set to where it needs to go. It's pretty foolproof. And I know there was a lot of people who got caught out at some of the worlds because they didn't have access to this. And suddenly they were like, hang on a second, like, how come you've completely lost your ability to have spatial reasoning? And it's like, yeah, I don't have a monitor tell me at all points in time where anyone who shoots a bullet is actually at, right? Because the other thing they had is the level of audio. So then you can use the level of audio is the distance.
Oh, okay.
So you literally had the ability to triangulate someone's position. And in PUBG, when the maps, like the game's all about like positioning and being on high ground and knowing where people's at, it's, yeah, bloody ridiculous. Team Fortress 2, Heroes of New Earth, the other ones I had as well with Heroes of New Earth. I think the one that was pretty common was they were sending, there's this item in the game that was called like a mana battery or something. And it basically, whenever someone was in range of the mana battery, if they cast an ability, you got a charge on your battery and you can always use your battery to get yourself some health back, right? But there's that area of effect around the mana battery. So basically to have a flag that's sending to you that if someone's in the area of effect, then you know that someone's near you, right?
Okay.
So then you're able to actually determine if there are people in the fog hiding away from you using abilities and you can just like have an indicator appear on the screen pretty much saying that someone's near you. So I remember that being like super dodge.
That's really cool.
And it's like, it's funny to think about these kind of things, which to me is subversions of how the games are supposed to be played. But like at the end of the day, it's a threat model problem, right? Because this information, you can obfuscate it. You can like, you know, make it harder to be able to work with it, or you can build it directly into the games so everyone has this player advantage. Like there's one in Team Fortress 2 that was really common for a long time, and they actually built this functionality into Team Fortress 2 because they got sick of people doing particle hacking. Particles in a game weren't actually part of SV Pure, which is the ability to effectively run a server with just base bog standard stuff without modifications. So people had it so that if you had overheal, then you would have a giant square above your head and if you were not overhealed, you would not have a square. And then it just meant that competitive players would choose who to fight and who not to fight in the game. Because they'll be like, oh, you have a square above your head. I am not going to fight you because you have a far more health than I anticipate. So I already know that this is a bad idea. So Valve actually took that and made it just create particle effects around people if they're overhealed now by default as part of the game.
Oh, that's sweet.
But that didn't exist for the first 4 years of Team Fortress 2. So you just had a bunch of nerds who had these particle hacks fucking installed and just like, oh, this, I love game hacking. It's just so many ways that it just goes a bit crazy.
That's very cool, man. Like what you're describing to me, I want to say that some of the game hackers that I met and some of these techniques that you're describing to me are extremely clever and are things that surprisingly they don't constitute like vulnerabilities in the purest sense, but they're in many ways what I would think of as oversights or misconfigurations or something that leads to an advantage. And you know, if we look at our industry and some of the vulnerabilities that we see in our industry as well, we'll also notice that some of the most successful ways of compromising something may not even involve having a vulnerability there to compromise something. And I know that a lot of the three-letter agencies, they really rely on things like misconfigurations and intended functionality many times that lets them do things that they probably shouldn't be able to do, which is kind of what you're describing to me with these game hacks that you've just gone through, which is very, very interesting because I see them in a very similar vein.
Yeah. So maybe we should just like, for all our three-letter agencies, just be like, did you play computer games? Were you hacking in high school? Okay, well, off you go to go work for our... TL8s over there. So yeah, Red Spice, right? Go find all the nerds who play like Overwatch 2 or like the new Breath of the Wild game that's coming out. So and just bring them across. So they'll figure it out. Dear. So you moved into Bug Bounty after that. And that's where you stayed for quite a while?
Yeah. So I got into Bug Bounties around 14. And after the PayPal bug that motivated me to continue working on this, I did have some issues briefly with, you know, just computer hacking at school and things like that, which is not an uncommon story for a lot of people in this industry. But unfortunately, that was something that really turned off my parents from letting me enter the field. In fact, my parents were insistent that I become a pharmacist, and they did not let me take any computer subjects in the last 2 years of high school. So I was basically doing all the sciences. And one of the other things that also happened during that time was, you know, my older brother had already graduated and he had received a really good mark in his final exam in year 12. And one of the things that was quite common for me to hear within my family due to how disruptive I was and how many issues I had with computer hacking and stuff and everything else was that, you know, I probably won't be able to make it to the university, but at least my brother's made it in, sort of thing. So that was something that I heard a lot back then. But when year 11 and year 12 hit, I decided that I would definitely beat my brother at any and all costs. So I started studying very, very hard. And I realized at that point that I can't learn things the same way that other people can in class. Like I can't just listen to someone talking to me for 30 minutes and learn a bunch of things. I have to be the one doing it in some way or form. And that's the only way I learn. Yeah, I started making videos. So I made, I think, 100 and something videos for all of the subjects that I was doing, which was like biology, chemistry, and all sorts of things. But I made a lot of these videos and I shared them with people in my class to help teach them about the concepts that we were learning. And I did fairly well in my final exam. I beat my brother, which is all I was aiming for. And after that, I was able to get accepted to University of New South Wales for computer science, which was my number one goal. At the time, I had just managed to convince my parents that there is a legitimate industry out there for computer security and they should let me study computer science, which I was grateful for that they came around to that, but it took a lot of convincing. Nowadays, it's a different world. Everyone knows that cybersecurity is a hot field and everyone knows that there's a lot of need for talent in this area. But back then, they wouldn't even really know about what we're talking about these days, and I don't think they fully understood that there was a real industry available for something like this. And that's not to their fault. They're obviously not people that have gone through the education system here in Australia, nor do they understand these things back then. It wasn't that popular. It's not, you know, in the media or anything like that. So I'm not saying that this was necessarily their fault, but back then it was a different world. And convincing them after I did, I was at University of New South Wales for around a year. And at the same time, as soon as I finished high school and I got my marks, I immediately emailed every InfoSec consultancy I could find in Sydney. And I listed a bunch of things that I had done. I gave them a resume, explained to them that I had, you know, done a lot of bug bounty work, had a bunch of vulnerabilities submitted to companies like Adobe, Microsoft, PayPal that had been accepted. And out of all the consultancies that I emailed, only one consultancy got back to me, which was Hack Labs at the time. And they agreed to put me on as an intern. But the journey there and back was dreadful. I mean, 3 hours usually all up, traveling from my place in Western Sydney to all the way Manly, which is a long way away. And it was an unpaid internship, so I didn't get paid for it at all. And I was there for around, I think it was around 3 to 6 months, I'd say. But I was grateful for that nonetheless. I was able to learn a lot about security consulting, getting to do pen tests myself, getting to write reports, getting to work with a team of other security enthusiasts as well. So I was very grateful for that opportunity and grateful that I was able to, you know, step into the industry at such a young age. I was just 17 at the time. But yeah, essentially I went to university and I ended up dropping out because, as I said earlier, I really struggle with learning things if I'm not really doing everything myself. And that was something that I really struggled with at university.
I know a lot of people have a similar story in a lot of ways. Like when I was at high school, I wasn't the best student. I liked getting out on Fridays and going and sprinting to the fish and chip shop and playing cards. Usually, I think we played a game called President or Nintendo DS, Metroid Prime Hunters and Mario Kart DS. That's all we did. And I think I came out with an ATAR 70 because I got lucky. But I got into university and I just went for a normal IT degree. And my parents just were happy because I was the first in my family to ever go to university, honestly. So I was just an achievement as far as they were concerned. And they were just happy to see me at uni. And I didn't really know, understand computers. And honestly, when I went to uni, I didn't really understand anything about, well, anything real, to be honest. I learned all my education through that. I just had a gear switch in my head where I said, wait a second, I don't want to be this like nerd who's just like, you know, just plays games all the time, doesn't care. I just want to actually just gun and do really good. This is a good way to reset and move forward in life. So I just like worked really hard at university and, you know, came out well and I got a good job in the public sector after that. But yeah, I know that university is not for everybody, but I do encourage people to go speak with a uni and see if it is for you, because some of the education, like you don't have to get a full qualification or accreditation at a university to be successful. Sometimes it's just those base skills around what is an array. How do you do a UML model? How do we talk about architecture and what is a, you know, DNS record? Those kind of things, that baseline skill set is often missing from a lot of entry-level professionals. And I see that a lot with cybersecurity graduates. I'm always worried when I see someone turns up with a master's of cybersecurity to an interview at my company. And I'm just like, oh no, have you guys done any IT programming, software engineering, whatever, hands-on stuff? And the answer is like pretty abysmal usually. So it scares me. But I like the video content as well. So why did you choose to make videos at high school, by the way?
It was because that was the only real way that I could learn. So the videos that I was creating, I had bought a Wacom tablet, which would let me write onto my screen and record it. And I would basically write out all of the things you needed to learn for whatever subjects. In the process of making these videos, I had to become an expert at any cost at any of these different areas. So for me, it was something that just through sheer discipline and hard work, I would release maybe one or two videos every day or two. And I did it as frequently as possible, but throughout the year, I only released around 100 or something videos. Even then, it was something that for me, it had a significant positive impact in learning. Now, just to kind of circle back a little bit on your university experience, I certainly don't discourage people from getting a university degree in any way or form. And there are benefits that go beyond just this baseline skill set, which is, you know, the ability to work in almost any country you want. Being in Australia, if you have a university degree, if you want to move to somewhere, having that university degree is sometimes the difference between being able to get a long-term visa and not being able to move there at all. So, I mean, for the people that have been fortunate enough to make their way through university, or not just fortunate, worked hard to make their way through university, I think they should be quite happy because it opens up a world of possibilities for them and opportunities in other countries as well.
And that's actually super accurate. I went through an interview process at Facebook and one of the pieces was like, you needed a university qualification to actually get apply for the E3 visa to even get across to there. So
yeah,
that was one of the screening questions after I did the on-sites, basically. So
yeah,
they've got a pretty cool campus, by the way, just very smelly. Salt Flats are not the greatest at Menlo Park. But and even with going to change.org at Canada, my visa sponsor, which didn't happen because of the COVID pandemic messing all that up, I still had to have a university qualification to even be considered by the Canadian government as someone to be able to move there.
Yeah.
So there's, if you want to go travel, go get a uni degree, right?
Yeah, no, for sure.
I'm sure that there's other reasons as well, but like I do think that baseline level across a wide variety of things and some theory that in practice, you wouldn't really pick up a lot of the theory stuff in my view. Like I was talking to one of my friends who's an entry-level programmer. He's just like self-taught. And you can build React apps, you can build Python applications. But then I ask him, like, what's the difference between using like an array and a linked list? And why would you consider using either of these? And it's a bit of a stunned mullet question. In fact, they didn't even know what the concept of an array is because they're a Python developer. Right. It's like, wait a second. This is different. Is this a slice? Is this spliced for Golang? So like these kind of basic computer science concepts do come up in security a lot. Like it's the little nuances between how things actually work and how people think that they work that actually lead to bugs being introduced into apps, right?
Yeah, fully agree with you. And on my side, I've been doing a lot of engineering as a part of Asset Note, and I've just started to learn over time how much of a knowledge gap I do have because I didn't go to university. And it's been very humbling bridging this gap. But as you said, like you'd probably cover a lot of it if you went to a university and did a computer science degree.
So that's probably a good transition. So you're the CTO of Asset Note. Do you want us to tell us a bit about Asset Note itself and like why you decided to start a company in the ASM space?
Yeah, sure. So Asset Note, we produce one product, our attack surface management product. We automatically map out and discover every asset on the internet that belongs to your organization. And we scan it for security exposures on an hourly basis. So very, very continuous. We're doing all of this discovery and security analysis 24/7, 365 days a year. It's completely automated, and it's a platform that we've built from ground up over the last 4.5 years. It's something that's capable of finding all the different subdomains, IPs, APIs across your attack surface at any given point in time. And yeah, it's something that we started originally. The background is I was doing a lot of bug bounties and doing a lot of automation for bug bounties. And when I was doing this, I came up with the concept of Asset Note initially as an open source project that I released at B-Sides Canberra, I think 2016, if I remember correctly. And yeah, I was going to stop working on it. I was going to completely stop working on it. I was done with it. I had released it. I mean, I was still using it, but I was not really planning to go further with it. One of my friends from Sweden, Matthias, he reached out to me and he said, this idea that you have around, you know, collecting recon data from a bunch of different sources and continuously monitoring it, it's a really good idea. You should continue working on it. And because he had faith in me and he had faith in the idea, it really motivated me to keep going. And at the time, his girlfriend was a project manager. So she basically set up a bunch of Trello boards, and Matthias and I just started programming more and more things into Asset Note. Although after a while, I think Matthias had other things going on as well, but I kept continuing working on Asset Note, and it had started becoming really, really good at discovering vulnerabilities in an automated fashion. So we're talking about vulnerabilities in Uber, Slack, all sorts of really large companies. And one day it even found a vulnerability in Slack that disclosed all of their source code and all of their hard-coded secret keys within the source code. And I think at that point I realized, wow, like this has real legs, the concepts that we've built here and the whole idea of automatic reconnaissance on a continuous basis and finding vulnerabilities on a continuous automated basis has some real legs, as the two components fit in nicely together, where the reconnaissance feeds into the ability to find things rapidly as they're being deployed. At that point, I'd tried getting the company off the ground and started, you know, trying to commercialize it. But to be frank, I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't have any of the business skills that I needed when it comes to sales, when it comes to legal, when it comes to accounting, and even just a general idea of how I would go to market with a product like this. And my whole worldview at the time was completely based off my technical roles and experience technically. And it's great for me to be able to program something that has real commercial value, but bringing it to market is a completely different skill set and requires a completely different mindset to what I had at the time. unfortunately, I failed the first few times taking it off the ground. And it was really interesting because I would tell my family, like, I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to focus on this. And they would say, you know, what are you doing? You could work for a nice company like Microsoft, have a sweet life, wake up like a decent time, sleep at a decent time, have a good family, whatever, all this stuff. And it was really like battling uphill from all different perspectives. In fact, most of the people that I told this idea to at the time didn't really believe or understand what I was talking about. And often they would claim that there were risks for this idea that would trump this idea in a matter of years. For example, one of the things that I would often get told is, this is not a viable business. In a few years' time, AWS and Azure will build something like this and they will take over this entire segment. And they'll tell me about all these different things. So at the time, I had a lot of uphill battles, even convincing the people around me that this had value. There were a few people that did see some value in it, and I'm grateful for that. And one of those people is my current co-founder, Michael. And when I started working on the business with Michael, we were able to actually commercialize this. We rewrote it from ground up. We built in everything that an enterprise customer would expect from something like this. Because one of the things we recognized early was what I had built for the bug bounty automation is not the same as what an enterprise customer wants. And it's not going to necessarily fit their needs. But yeah, that's how Asynote came to be. And Michael and I have been working on it for just over four and a half years. And it's been going excellently so far.
That's a fantastic story, man. There's a few things I really want to talk through there as well. But I guess, like, as a founder myself, also had a similar situation to you in that, oh, yeah, I'm great at AppSec. People will just buy AppSec services. Done. That's it. I don't need to go to market. I don't need to do sales. I don't need to do marketing. Turns out that that's bloody stupid. Yeah. And that I have now learned that I'm my best salesman effectively. And I need to be actively soliciting and finding pipeline to work with, right? So you learn these kind of things as you start a business and fail and then pick it up and then fail. And, you know, the setbacks and also people telling you that it's risky, I really see that a lot as well. I would argue that if you're working for a big company, that is also risky because, like, we've seen in the last year that tons of large institutions are laying off really good people.
Yeah.
Right. So are you really in control of your own destiny if you are working for a big corporate like a Microsoft or Google when they can just let you go at any point? Or would you prefer to take it into your own hands, build your own client base, and then have, you know, surety and success in yourself? I think it's actually more of a risk to just like kind of cruise than it is like, because your skills will degrade over time. You'll have a smaller network. You're not doing the things you need to do to set yourself up in the future. So it's really good that you're able to push past all that negativity and criticism and say, like, actually, I really do have confidence in my idea. I don't know why other people aren't seeing that, but, you know. And the other thing, people just don't want to put money on the table for stuff, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're going to be very afraid to invest in things. But, like, I guess you found some early investors who really did see that there was a lot of potential in your business, and that's really helped you move, right?
No, so we're a completely bootstrapped business.
That's like the best place to be, man. If you're bootstrapped, like, you are set.
and it's the same for you, right, Cole? I mean, coming from the bootstrapped world, I think Michael and I did have to put quite a bit of money in initially to get some of the initial funding for the company off the ground, but that wasn't anything significant, nothing like what a seed round would be or a Series A would be or anything like that. And, you know, surprisingly, we have had instances where, you know, the company was on the brink of extinction because we just didn't have any more money left in the tank, Michael and I. We had this one situation where, you know, our bills for our cloud providers were going up because we were starting to onboard people. We didn't necessarily have that much money coming in. And we were speaking to an investor here in Sydney. And we flew to Sydney. We pitched them. We talked to everyone there. And they were like, yeah, we just don't see it. And we were like, oh, okay, no worries. And at the time, if they had given us seed funding, due to the dire situation we were in, we probably would have taken it. But because they didn't give it to us, we ended up actually contacting a friend of a friend who worked at AWS, and they were able to give us $100,000 credits in AWS Cloud Compute. And that was all we needed to ensure that the company didn't need any external funding, really. Because after that, and I'm really grateful for this, because normally this is only given to AWS customers that have been funded by VCs, but the team at AWS had made an exception after seeing some of the customers that were onboarding with us. And I'm really grateful for that decision because it meant that Michael and I could focus on actually building the product and business without having to worry about our huge infrastructure spends that we had early on. But yeah, I mean, I'm really grateful for the fact that it's a bootstrap business. It means that both Michael and I can drive this business however we want. And I'm sure it's the same for you, Cole. If you have any thoughts on this and your bootstrap journey, I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, so there's a lot of things that I've messed up. One thing I really struggled with early on was I really wanted to get good talent and I had really strong values. I still do. I really want to look after people and help to nurture them and grow and build talent, especially in AppSec. I see a vacuum at the moment where people get taken to big technology companies on ludicrous wages and then that's it. They're there. And I think that that's really bad for the industry because it means that we have so many other areas that just have no mind share about where product security, application security is. And it's just not even a concern. And they're getting constantly breached in the space, right? So I could have quite easily taken a role at some big tech company and sat there as a product security engineer and $500,000 a year or something stupid, right? But I think that as soon as you do that kind of stuff, you're not really committing to what I really wanted to do, which is like to get this on as a national conversation for people and say like, hey, I need to get this moving, right? So I still really believe that that is the trend. Software has eaten the world and now AI is eating software. we're moving in that direction. So I'm really trying to promote that vision and get that mindset going. But what I did really badly was I took my values and vision too far without commercializing it successfully, right? Yeah. A few things I don't recommend doing is having a baby when you're just getting a business off the ground. It turns out that if you can't be 100% committed, you're kind of screwed.
Yeah.
Paying attention to finances is actually really important. I tried to delegate that responsibility away and it's bitten me, right? So I now am actively chasing invoices, sending out statements of work and making sure people pay things up front and managing cash flow, building future pipeline. That's one of the things that kills small business owners, I guess, is that they don't think through, like they're just like, oh, I'm a security consultant, you know, my wage is this, this is great. And then there's downturns, there's tax, there's staff contributions and payroll. Like there's a lot of things you need to be aware of that. And I'm not discouraging people from, you know, like starting a business and learning all of these kind of things. What I am saying is that you need to be hands-on and wear many different hats. And if you're not prepared to put on the sales hat and go up to someone and say, actually, I'm great at application security. I can solve problems for you. I know this is sales. Just let me help you. And if you're just going to say like, actually, they're going to come to me, that's not going to happen. And you found that as well when you're trying to commercialize AssetNote too, right? You're like, you're number one bug bounty hacker person in the world, yet still unable to sell your product, right? Because the people who respect you are not the ones who are purchasing authority in these large enterprises, yeah.
So surprisingly, it's been kind of different for us for that specific aspect. Firstly, I just want to touch on your point around all the other things you need to do to have a successful business, which is, as you mentioned earlier, managing cash flow, payroll, all that sort of stuff. I'm really fortunate that Michael helps a ton with that, in fact, does most of that. But we get a lot of external help for that as well. We hire BDO for all of our accounting purposes. We have like a virtual CFO that we consult with on a regular basis to learn about, you know, how we are doing as a business and things like that. But as a solo founder, like I really, really know that you would have to have done so much of this work alongside all of the other work you need to do. And, you know, Michael, my co-founder, he manages basically everything to do with the business and sales. And I manage pretty much everything to do with technology. Michael often also really gets involved with product decisions as well and designing user experience and things like that as well. And, you know, one of the things that I love about this stuff is we're not afraid of doing anything that's necessary. Really, for me, what that looks like is I'm often dealing with support tickets like all the time. And, you know, some people might think, oh, you know, I'm the CTO of a business. Why do I have to do all the support tickets? And sure, you can feel that sometimes. But I know that with me doing that work, it's going to have the most positive impact possible for our customers. And I know that it's going to be something that leads to a lot of positive reviews of our software and our work. And there's also a bunch of things that I like doing that means that our developers get to do what they're supposed to do, which is actually engineering, as opposed to investigations and customer support and other things like that, that I don't want them to be spending as much time on. And I know that you're very similar in this vein, where you try and take on a lot of responsibilities that, you know, it's anything and everything that you need to do for the business. It's not about what the job is. It's just about getting it done and moving forward. And we're not so precious to think, oh, you know, my role is this, so I'm only going to do this, or it's not worth my time or anything like that. We don't think that way. And I think that it kind of loops back to what you were talking about earlier around, you know, thinking about our background and, you know, our parents who had to do these really, you know, mundane things and jobs that they had to work very hard, wake up at 2 a.m. every day, whatever it may be. And we compare that situation to us and we still have it really good at the end of the day. Anyways, that's a bit of a tangent, but I just wanted to touch on that point because I think that you, like what you're saying to me is, again, really resonating with me as something that I've had to do as a founder, a co-founder as well.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate the kind words. And yeah, I encourage people to go and actually start businesses. Start small. There's nothing wrong with having it as a side hustle. You know, go build a product and just try to sell it to people and see how it goes. You know, I guarantee that the majority of people that you speak with will give you feedback in one way or another. But the thing is, it's still feedback, right? So if it's a bunch of LinkedIn connections sending nasty messages to you, then you're probably not solving a problem that is actually relevant to them. It could be your pitch. It could be your tech. It could be the fact that you're using Sales Navigator badly and targeting the wrong personas. But these are all things that you need to be able to work out for part of your sales strategy, as well as like, what product or service am I actually trying to sell? It's a journey. And I think that it'd be very difficult for me to go back to a corporate position now that I've been running a business for, you know, a few years now. So I imagine that you're in a similar boat.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it'll be a huge transition, but I don't think I'll enjoy it as much for sure.
All right. So I'm going to move into the rapid fire questions that we have.
Okay.
Question number one, if you were to give a book to someone at Christmas, what book is it and why?
Tangled Web. And because it covers a lot of really unique concepts with web application security.
That's Michal Zelinsky, is it?
Yes, I think so. Yep.
He wrote another book recently called Doom, didn't he? Doomsday or something?
Yes, I think, yes, he did. He wrote a Doomsday Prepping Guidebook. So he has a wide range of skills, ranging from web application security to Doomsday Prep.
Oh, dear. Maybe I should pick up both of those books. So what's so good about the Tangled Web, though? Is it still relevant? Because I remember it came out in 2013 or 12, didn't it? So the web's changed a lot since then, right?
Yeah, so it's not as relevant, right? It's the web's changed way too much for it to be super relevant today. But what I found when I was working at Bishop Fox as a security consultant was I would come up with these really gnarly client-side exploitation techniques, and I'd mention it in the group company chat, and they'd say, hey man, that's like on page 96 of the Tangled Web. And I'd be like, really? Damn it. I thought I came up with something really unique and really new. So I would always get referred back to this book, and I read through the whole book, and it's just the mindset that he teaches about how to approach client-side security that I really love.
I think I need to pick it up as well. The books I've been reading lately is How to Design Secure Software.
Okay.
And also the books about how to enroll kids in private schools, which is not terribly interesting, but maybe one day you'll be at that point in your life where you have to think about that. Cool. Next question. What's the best purchase you've made for under $100 and why?
Under $100. I think the best purchase I've made for under $100 is like a cheap digital watch, really. I mean, it's been quite useful for me. There's not that many things I can think of under $100, but if I can say over $100, then it would probably have to be my Mac Studio, probably.
What's a Mac Studio?
So it's a desktop Mac, basically, that was released a year or two ago. It's been incredibly good when it comes to source code auditing and really heavy workloads. I would always find that any machine that I would use wouldn't be able to handle the amount of ADHD energy that I had. So this Mac Studio does that quite well.
I guess it's going to go on everyone's procurement list. We need these Mac Studios in every single professional pen tester's lab. Done.
Yeah.
I just have a bunch of like bad monitors. So I've got like two Dell ones that cost me like $12 each. So I picked at a secondhand store and I've just shoved them on monitors and they do what they need to do. Yeah, I guess like a lot of the source code auditing I do is about just like spending the time working with engineers initially to just really understand the history of the application before I actually ever dig into it. But I think from a bug bounty perspective, you don't get to have one-on-one time with engineers to actually talk through why is it like this.
Yeah, and also you're spinning up heaps of VMs, you're decompiling source code, and you've got like 50 things going on at once, I guess. But I would love to be, I mean, I was actually, when I was working at Bishop Fox, I was doing what you were doing with source code analysis, and I was speaking to customers and auditing their code. And that was excellent. I think I learned the most when I was doing that by actually having that interaction with the customers. Nowadays, I'm just sitting here guessing, trying to figure out what the developer was trying to do at that point in time when he wrote that code. So it's a lot more guesswork these days.
When you have access to the developers who are still writing the source code, they'll probably question, why did the previous developers do this in the first place, yeah. Right? So
yeah.
I swear there's like a market for a product that does code archaeology, right?
Yeah.
So you just like dump a Git repository there and you say, give me the history of this. Why did people do all of these things? Tell me more.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
maybe that's our next startup idea together. So I don't know how I'd sell it. I'll just steal Michael. So Shubs, one more, I guess one final question. Our audience kind of leans towards like younger viewers, but I also think it's important to cater for some of the more senior members of the crew. So I guess maybe there's two questions then. Question one, what tip would you give to people who are relatively new to cybersecurity who are looking to get better at bug bounty? And number two would be, if you're a senior leader in cybersecurity, what can you do to help others?
Okay. For the people coming into the industry and wanting to get into bug bounties, I recommend just diving into it, not being discouraged, being persistent, and trying to learn as many fundamentals as possible before you dive into it, obviously. Things like Pentester Lab, Web Security Academy, you know, Try Hack Me, Hack the Box. All of these are great resources for beginners. Just really diving into it. Like, even if you don't find anything at all for a week, you've still learned a lot in that week. So that's my opinion on it. And I think that's the best way to do it. And when it comes to the older crew or the people that are in more senior positions in this industry, I would just say, don't be hesitant to give people a shot, even if they're very young. And I think that, you know, as time goes on, we're seeing the barrier of entry decrease. You know, I was incredibly fortunate that someone gave me a shot when I was 17. And I don't think I'd be here necessarily in the position I am today if I hadn't had that opportunity. So yeah, don't be afraid to give younger people a shot if they show promise. I'm not saying just give a random 17-year-old a job, but you know, if they come to the table with, you know, some good experience that they've got from recreational activities or things they've done in their free time, I would really consider giving them a shot.
It's good to be open-minded. I think that it's pretty easy as a security professional to have this negative, closed-minded attitude because that's effectively what the industry is reinforcing. You know, we say no, we try to stop things from happening. We're here to make things slow and implement guardrails so people can't shoot themselves in the foot, right? So, and I guess that mindset does permeate into hiring decisions. These people need to have an OSCP. They need to be able to explain what's the difference between a CNAME and a quad A. And, you know, and I'm sitting there thinking to myself, I'm pretty certain that my early job interviews were just like, pretty silly now. Like, just what is a computer? How do I compute? And then you seem all right. In you go. So I'm fortunate as well. So yeah, really great answers, Shubs. Thank you so much for coming on to the Secured podcast, and we'll stay in touch. I'll have you on in the future.
Thanks for having me, Cole.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Secured. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Don't forget to follow the podcast on your favorite platform and leave us a review. Want some more content like the above? Why not subscribe to our newsletter at galarcyber.com.au/newsletter and get high-quality AppSec content straight to your mailbox. Stay safe, stay secure, and we'll see you next episode.
If you're new to the show or a seasoned veteran, I want to hear from you. I'm always looking to do better as a podcast host and as a person. So tell me about what I can do better. Tell me about the types of people you want on my podcast. Tell me about if the format's working for you or styles need to be switched up. Do I need to interview differently? So on and so forth. I appreciate you sticking with me for almost 30 episodes at this stage. And I hope I can keep learning and you can keep learning and being entertained for many more episodes to come. So please shoot me feedback. I want the good, the bad, and the ugly to pod@galarcyber.com.au. And if you don't like email, hit me up on LinkedIn.